name is Kim Mutcherson, co-dean of Rutgers Law School in Camden, and this is The Power of Attorney. Now, I know I always say this every single episode, but this is a very exciting episode. We have one of our alums here to talk with us today, and I'm extremely excited to talk about his origin story and how he moved from Rutgers Law into a very exciting life as a lawyer and as a politician. So welcome to Power of Attorney, Adam Taliaferro. It is so, so, so wonderful to have you here. Thanks so much for your time.
Kim, thank you so much. It's my honor, my privilege to be speaking with you, and anything Rutgers Law related is a good day for me.
Oh, fantastic. That's good to hear. So, you know, usually what I do when we start these podcasts is I ask people for their origin story, right? How is it that they ended up in law school? I think for you, one, there are going to be lots of people who know at least bits and pieces of your origin story, but there will also be folks who don't know it. So I want to sort of start with the beginning and not start with law school. And the beginning, if I'm right, is a kid growing up who loved football and wanted to be a football player. Is that fair?
You are absolutely right. I started playing football. I grew up in South Jersey in a town called Voorhees. And from the age of seven, my goal and my dream was to play professional football. And I was always a smaller guy. So my mom was never thrilled with the fact that I wanted to play football. But, thankfully, everything went well. I went to Eastern High School, which is also in Voorhees, and that's when my football career really blossomed. And then I had the opportunity to go on and play at Penn State.
Yeah. So there's something really extraordinary about identifying at 7 years old your goal for your lifetime, right? What was it that appealed to you about football?
You know, it was still to this day, I haven't found anything that attracted me to the level that football did. I remember the very first time I put on my helmet and put on my uniform, I got this feeling that went through me that I had really never felt before. And I remember going out to practice for the first time and holding the football. And it was just like, you know, I felt like that was what I was meant to do. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to put into words, but I just fell in love with the game from a very young age. And, you know, my dad played football growing up, and he was the one that really first put the ball on my hand. But I just had this natural affinity towards the sport that has stuck with me throughout my entire childhood.
I love that. So you were, you know, one of those people who identified what you wanted to do at a very young age, and then basically, you know, built your life around getting to the point where you could play big time college football with the goal ultimately of ending up in the NFL. So you did great in high school. You got recruited to go to Penn State, which again is big time college football. And very early on in your football career, things went awry. Is it okay if I ask you to talk about that game with Ohio State and where things went from there?
Absolutely. You know, as you mentioned, it was very early. It's only the fifth game of my freshman year at Penn State. I was playing in a game, and I was playing defensive back, so I was on the defensive side of the ball, and my job was to tackle the ball carrier. And the play happened, a routine play that I had been through thousands of times while playing football. I went to make a tackle, to tackle the running back, and I unfortunately had my head down when I made impact, and the impact of the tackle caused me to break my neck, and I severely bruised my spinal cord. And I tell people all the time, you know, when you have these kind of injuries, I remember laying on the ground trying to get up and nothing was moving. But the thought of being paralyzed never went through my head because, you know, in life, you watch the news, you read the newspaper, you hear about all the bad things that happen. You always think that's going to be somebody else. Mm. So although I couldn't move, the thought of being paralyzed didn't go through my head. I just thought I was, you know, injured, but I'd be back flying home with my teammates later on that evening. Right. But unfortunately, when they took me to the hospital, they saw the severity of my injury. And unfortunately, their initial prognosis was that I would never walk again.
Right, right. And so they had to, they brought you to Philly, right? Mm-hmm. And and that's where you had surgery?
I had my surgery actually in Ohio. The injury was bad, but I was very fortunate to have had my injury in Ohio because right on campus at Ohio State, they have a nationally recognized spinal cord center right on campus. So
wow.
I had my surgery out there And I was in intensive care there for a week, and then they airlifted me back to Philadelphia, closer to home, to begin my recovery.
Right, right. And I can't imagine, I mean, you were quite young. And I can't imagine what it must have felt like, you know, to wake up and to be told that you had, what, a 3% chance of walking again. That's an extraordinary moment for a young person, particularly somebody who was an athlete. So did you think to yourself, well, I'm gonna beat the odds here?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head when you talk about the brevity of the condition I was in, and my parents realized that as well. Because I was 17, and you know, my parents weren't at the game that day, but that evening they flew out to Ohio, and that's when the doctors first told my parents how bleak the prognosis was. Mm-hmm. But my parents made the decision, knowing how young I was and the potential impact that would have on my recovery, hearing such bad news, they made the decision not to tell me. So I never knew how severe the prognosis was.
Wow. You know, I can definitely see people who would say, you know, that was not the direction to go in. And yet, as a parent, I can completely see, you know, why they would have made that decision. And do you feel like that was the, I mean, obviously the outcome has been really fantastic.
Yeah.
But do you feel like not having that information actually put you in a better position to think this is a bad experience, but it's a temporary experience?
I think so, because what I learned going, you know, looking back on that injury and having an opportunity to be around a lot of folks that were dealing with the same type of injury, is that getting through a spinal cord injury is, of course, physical, but a big part of it is the mental mindset that you bring into your recovery process. And when you have such bad news early on, it's easy to get down. It's easy to begin thinking negatively, not believing that you'll ever walk again. But, you know, I had no choice but to be positive and say, hey, I'm gonna walk out of this. And that was the mindset I went into from my very first rehabilitation session, that, you know, this is going to be a tough process, but I'm going to come out of it. And having that positive mindset, I think, really helped me in my early recovery.
Yeah, I would think so. So you spent, what, about 8 months, I think, right?
Yeah.
You know, just in rehab and physical therapy. Do you remember what it was like to be able to take those first steps?
Yeah. You know, for me, I often equate it to like a baby taking their first step. You know, that excitement in the household when you see your, you know, for those that have kids, when you see your little one taking their first steps, that's how it was with me.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the strangest thing. I would try to remember what it was like to walk, and it just felt like my body completely forgot. But as you mentioned, over the 8 months, I relearned the process. And then when it came to the point to finally take that first step, you know, my entire family was there, and we had like a celebration that I was finally walking again. And, you know, I was taking very small steps, but it was like, you know, hey, I had a new lease on life. And, you know, I tell people all the time, you know, I took those steps, but there were so many people, my family, my physical therapist, so many in the community that prayed for me to mm-hmm. really help me get to that point. And without that support, that day would have never have happened.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's an extraordinary story and an extraordinary example of what people can achieve, right? When they have, as you say, the right mindset and also have the kind of support around you that you were able to have and access to good healthcare, right?
Absolutely.
In order to be able to do the rehab that was necessary. So I'm not, you know, I'm not a big sports person. I'm not a big football person, but one of the pieces of your story that I think is just, that must have, it seems to me that must have felt so amazing and tremendous is you being able to walk back into the stadium after folks had seen you have this catastrophic injury, and then to come back in this sort of what feels to me like it must have felt really triumphant. You know, can you describe that moment?
Yeah, you know, even before I could walk, my teammates would come to the hospital, my coaches would come to visit me, and about 3 months into my recovery, my coaches said, hey, you know, Adam, when you walk again, we want you to lead the team out the tunnel. And it was kind of a joke at that time, because I was like, you know, I'm not even walking, and these guys are already talking about me leading the team out the tunnel. But the thing that it really provided for me was a goal. It gave me something to work towards throughout that entire 8-month recovery. And then when I was fortunate enough to get out, I felt like I was a football player all over again, because I was practicing that moment of coming out the tunnel. Mm-hmm. And I remember it was our first game of our season, and it was 100,000 people in the stadium. And as I'm walking through the tunnel, I just heard this roar go through the crowd, and something went through me that I had never felt before. And it inspired me to walk and run. And I didn't think I could run at that time. And I ran out a little bit. And for me, it was just, as you had mentioned, it was a triumphant moment, not just for me, but for so many people that supported me. My parents were in the stadium, my physical therapist, and so many people that prayed for me were in the stadium. And for me, it was just to show everybody that I was okay again. And also to thank so many people for their support over that last year to get me to that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's sort of one of those things where, and again, I'm not necessarily a big sports fan, but there are certain moments that even if you're not a sports fan, you know that they happened, because they're such sort of lightning moments. And certainly for somebody who was as young as you were, who was incredibly, promising as an athlete, who was playing at a big time, in a big time football program, to have you come back, I think was probably an incredibly inspirational story for a lot of people.
Yeah, I will forever be thankful for that moment. I got to be careful because I'm married now and I have two kids, so I can't say it's the best moment of my life, but it is definitely up there.
Absolutely. So I want to transition now to talking about, what happens when you have a dream from the time you're 7 years old, and that dream is that you're going to end up in the NFL, and then you have this really significant injury, which you recover from, but which puts you in a position where that dream is now elusive, right? And you have to sort of think about, all right, well, what's going to be next? And you're still very young. What was the process like to sort of figure out, all right, this thing that I was going to do is no longer on the table. So, what's next for me? How did you work through that? And who helped you work through that?
Yeah, Kim, I would be lying to you if I said that it was something that just clicked overnight. I struggled for a while. I went through this 8-month journey of recovering. Then I went back to Penn State to restart my academic career. And mm-hmm. I remember getting back to campus and I was no longer a football player. The team was fantastic. They kept me part of the program. I was still with the guys, but I was no longer out there playing anymore. Right. And I struggled with it. And there were often times I would say, why me? Out of all the people in the world, how could this happen to me? But what really was a benefit to me was just having such a great support staff, where my guidance counselors at Penn State, and also my coaches, my coach at the time, Coach Paterno, every day that I would walk into the football building, he would say, what do you want to do with your life? Mm. And I couldn't answer that question, to be perfectly honest with you. And he directed me to, back to my guidance counselor, and they had me take a test. Some folks that are listening may have taken the same test where you answer a bunch of random questions. And at the end of the test, it tells you what you may be interested in life or as a potential career. And for me, it came out as something in the law field. And I never, nobody in my family was lawyers. I never had thought about being a lawyer. But, I remember going back home to my apartment that evening. And I told my roommate, I said, his name was Tony. I said, Tony, I took this test and it says I may be interested in the law field. And I remember him saying, he said, Adam, that's for smart people, right? Yeah. My own roommate doesn't believe in me, but that little test was what started me on my career towards the law.
Oh, that's great. So then how did you end up at Rutgers Law School in Camden? And I know that part of that story involves Camille Andrews, who was our former admissions dean. So I'd love to hear how she roped you into a Rutgers Law education.
Yeah. So, after I took that test and I decided I wanted to go towards the law field, I said, I can't play football anymore, but I would love to be able to represent my teammates that go on to play in the NFL. I want to be their attorney. I want to be their agent. So I decided, okay, I'm going to go to law school. I started looking around at law schools. And for me, I said, maybe I can come back closer to home, or maybe I could stay at Penn State. But I came home and I had an opportunity to have lunch with Dean Andrews and took a tour of Rutgers Law School and had some friends that had gone through Rutgers Law School and heard nothing but good things about it. And I was kind of hooked from that my first tour at Rutgers Law. As I say, the rest is history. And I started on my journey towards applying to Rutgers Law, and I was fortunate enough to get in. And I tell people it's one of the best decisions I ever made.
Oh, good. I like that. So I always love to talk to people about what it was like to be a law student, particularly folks who don't necessarily have lawyers in their family and sort of, you know, walked into this space. And law school is a very distinctive experience that is quite different from being in undergraduate school. So what was that transition like, particularly that first year, which is the year when people often get really hammered by the experience?
I remember telling people I was going to law school. The first thing everyone would say was, it is so hard. It's going to be so much reading. You know, are you sure you want to do it? And people had made me so nervous that I applied to, I took a summer course early. So I took contracts over the summer with Professor Feynman.
Oh, great.
And I remember just being so nervous in there. And the thing that I will always give credit to Professor Feynman for was that he made the class enjoyable. He made it understandable. He said, you know, there's nothing to be nervous and scared about. We're all going to learn together. And I took that contracts course over the summer, and I realized, you know, law school is not such a big, bad, scary place.
Yeah.
You know, we're all here to learn with one another. And, you know, all me and my fellow classmates, we got through that summer. So I went into the fall, you know, confident for my first year of, you know, full law courses. And it was like everyone else, you know, it was a lot of reading, but you get accustomed to it. And I just, you know, I may be a little bit biased, but I said that the professors at Rutgers Law just did such a fantastic job of making the content understandable, building the confidence, and being available before and after class if I had questions. You know, I just felt like it was a community of people that were all there to help you get through. And it may sound crazy, but I tell people my first year was enjoyable.
Okay.
It taught me to think a different way. Yeah. It was just a unique experience that I look back on fondly.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I often say to first year students, particularly students who, you know, are struggling and just feel so kind of confused by the experience, I say to them, you're learning both a new way to think and a new language. And that's hard, right? And it takes time, and you have to sort of give yourself some grace to build up to a point where it all starts to come together, right? For most people, it's not going to all start to come together on day one. It's going to take a little bit of time for sure. So I'm glad to hear that that your experience was that the professors were a really important part of helping you make that transition. We always hope that that's going to be the case for folks. Are there any particular classes or professors that you remember with a very, very high level of fondness, right? Those people who you'll kind of never forget?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, I think, you know, Professor Feynman, because he was my first, you know, he was the professor that introduced me to the law school world. And I'm so hesitant because I'm thinking back, there were so many that I look back on and I smile about. But the thing I tell people, Professor Robbins, who was my legal writing professor, because even to this day, I was not a confident writer. I always wasn't sure if my writing was good enough. And, you know, she spent so much time with me and helping me to craft and refine my writing my first year. If I had to probably say anybody, I probably spent the most time with her my first year. Even to this day, we'll talk later. I'm in public service, and she was walking through the state house, and I saw her, and in my it just brought back so many great memories. And you know, we still talk to this day. So I'm just so, you know, thankful that the experts and the wonderful law professors that are at Rutgers really helped prepare me for life after law school.
Terrific. So you said once you took the test and the test said, hey, go be a lawyer. and you were thinking to yourself that you would become a lawyer who could work with athletes, right? Who could work with the kind of folks that you had been playing football with as they moved into their careers. But that is not what you ended up doing. So was there a particular point where you kind of shifted focus about what you wanted to do with your law degree?
Yeah, I think it was, no, actually prior to my first year in law school, I had the opportunity to intern with an NFL agent and really see what it was like to be an agent on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, you see it on TV and it looks so glamorous and luxurious. Then when you have the opportunity to see it up close and personal, you realize that it's not as luxurious as you thought it was. And I quickly realized that I don't know if I want to be basing my livelihood on the decisions of young, crazy athletes.
Right.
I decided, and also that summer, I was fortunate to spend a few weeks at Montgomery McCracken in Philadelphia as an unpaid intern and just get a little glimpse into the corporate law side of the business. And I thought, you know what, this may be something that I'm interested in, particularly around labor and employment law. Mm-hmm. So I quickly shifted towards seeking opportunities to work in the corporate litigation setting.
Got it. And then, so when you graduated, you did a little bit of law firm work, but then you ended up going to Bristol-Myers Squibb. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what the work is that you were doing there or are doing there?
Yeah. So I, as you mentioned, I was, you know, working at a corporate litigation firm in Philadelphia for about 4 years. And I just, for me, I had my injury and healthcare advocacy was something that was so important to me, not only in my personal life, but I wanted to get more involved on the professional side. So I started looking around for different opportunities. And, you know, we all talk about networking and getting to know people. And I tried to do that to the best of my ability. And I got to know some folks that worked over at Bristol-Myers, and an opportunity arose to join Bristol-Myers Squibb in our health advocacy department. So I came over to Bristol-Myers. And I was a policy advocate. So I worked, my main role was working with patient advocates, helping them to better understand the policies at the state level that are beneficial to them and getting access to the medications that they need. And I did that role for a couple of years. And then we had a merger at BMS, and all of us on the health advocacy side joined the state government affairs department. So through that integration, I became a lobbyist for Bristol-Myers. And it quickly moved over into the lobbying field. So I was a lobbyist for Bristol-Myers, covering about 5 states for them, and did that for 3 years. And then I transitioned, you know, outside of my work at Bristol-Myers, I started to get involved in public service and politics. And what I quickly found was it was a little bit of a conflict to be in public service and serving as a legislator and also serving as a lobbyist for Bristol-Myers. So, Bristol-Myers was really great with allowing me to move back to advocacy, which was really my first love, and which is what I still do to this day at Bristol-Myers. So I lead our patient advocacy efforts in 12 states and going back to educating patients on policies and helping them better understand how they can get better access to healthcare.
I love that. And I obviously want to get into, you know, your work in the assembly and your foundation work, but I also want to talk about a law career that doesn't look like what people often imagine a lawyer is going to do coming out of law school. And the reason why I'd love to hear you talk about that is, you know, one of the things that we say to students all the time, whether they're in law school or people who are thinking about law school, is, oh, there's so many different things that you can do with a law degree. But then, you know, their field of vision oftentimes gets very narrow at various points. And you're a person who has used your law degree, I think, in a really interesting way in terms of the work that you've done at Bristol-Myers. And so I would love for you to sort of talk about how, you know, you're doing advocacy work, but you're not, you know, you're not in a courtroom and you're not, you know, writing briefs. Right. So, you know, what are the ways in which your training as a lawyer is integral and really critical to the kind of work that you're doing, both in educating and advocating for patients and helping them advocate for themselves?
Yeah, and I think you're so right, because even when I was a law student, I just had that narrow view you spoke about, like, I've got to be at a law firm, you know, I want to be a partner one day, and that was it. But as I started to really look at the landscape, and I had so many people tell me, you know, you can do so many different things with your law degree, And it took me actually a few years after law school to realize that. And I tell people all the time, my law degree helped me get my foot in the door. Mm-hmm. I would not have had the opportunity at Bristol-Myers Squibb if they didn't look on my resume and see that I had a law degree. And that law degree helped them to better understand and know that I had the ability to think differently, mm-hmm. the ability to evaluate. And in my role now, I'm looking at legislation every day. And if you can read a legal brief, you can easily read a piece of legislation. So I think I tell law students all the time, the way that you're learning to think will open up so many different opportunities, whether it's within a law firm, but even more so outside of the law firm setting. So I have never stepped foot in the law in a courtroom after I graduated from Rutgers Law School. Mm-hmm. But I use the skills and my law degree each and every day in my role, because as you mentioned earlier, I am helping patients understand the laws that are written by attorneys all the time. So it's that's why I smile whenever I think about, or whenever I hear someone going to law school, I smile, because it really is the key to opening up so many different doors, and some of those doors you may not even know exist.
Yeah.
When you're walking into the law school.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's so critical for students to keep an open mind, right? To recognize that if you have blinders on and you come into school and say, this is what I'm going to do, and there's nothing else that's there for me, that you might actually miss out on some really great opportunities. So that's my little bit of life advice in this podcast to all of our students out there. So I said I did want to transition into talking about your career as a politician, and then I also wanted to talk about your foundation. So let's start with the politician piece. So you are presently a member of the General Assembly in the New Jersey State Legislature, and can you just sort of describe for folks what a typical day is like for you?
Yeah, so I've been in the legislature for 6 years now, serving on the General Assembly side. And, the thing that I really enjoy about serving in the legislature is that there typically is no typical day. But, I would say from our side, in New Jersey, we're what you call a citizens legislature. So 80 to 85% of the legislators in the state have full-time employment outside of their roles in the legislature. So it provides a lot of flexibility to really make your position your own. So I have the honor and privilege of chairing our Law and Public Safety Committee within the legislature. So I deal with a lot of policing type issues. So from day to day, the way that my day goes is in the morning, either early in the mornings or later on in the evening hours outside of my BMS time, I try to take constituent calls or respond to constituent inquiries. But also we have committees. So my committee meetings are usually, 3 or 4 days out of the month, where we bring, testimony in, and we pass, bills out of our committee for their, full assembly to consider. And then we also have our full voting sessions, which are usually 2 or 3 days out of the month. So it's been quite the unique experience. The thing I tell people is I'm a person, I enjoy being liked by people. That, who doesn't? But, when you get involved in public service, you realize you could be a very nice person, but there's going to be folks that just aren't a fan of yours because of your political affiliation or because of the way you voted on a specific issue. But I try to, at the end of the day, I don't know how long I'm going to be in the legislature, but while I'm in here, is to try to help in my own little way. I got involved in public service because I've been tremendously assisted throughout my entire life, mostly, more so during my injury. I saw how good people can be when they come together. Mm-hmm. And that's the mindset I take into, my service in the legislature. I don't, I try to the greatest extent not to be partisan. I say when I played sports, I didn't know if my teammates were Republicans or Democrats. I just knew we were all pushing in the same direction. Mm-hmm. And that's how I try to how I focus when I'm serving. And I've enjoyed it. It's had some tough times. There's been some tough issues, but that's what makes this job unique and fun. You meet a lot of good people. You get to interact with with so many wonderful people throughout the state, but most importantly, you get to help people. And I think that's what it's all about.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is really great that you share that maybe a lot of people don't recognize is that there are lots of state legislatures where folks, as you say, have full-time jobs and then are also, you know, part of the legislative body in their state. And one of the critiques we often see of Congress is this idea that, you know, these are people who are living in this sort of very rarefied air and who don't understand the lives of their constituents and, you know, don't interact with their constituents enough and, you know, don't really know what it's like to kind of be a real person who walks on the ground. Is it your sense that because you are in a legislative body where folks are, you know, sort of living real lives in a way, that it's useful for the work that you do and the work that your colleagues do?
I completely agree. I think, you know, you look around our legislature, you got small business owners, you got lawyers, you got people from all walks of life that are bringing their real life experiences to their votes. And I think it's been a tremendous help to have that aspect within our legislature, because I think, you know, when you do get removed from the everyday life of either working a job or dealing with, you know, issues that we all deal with on a day-to-day basis, I think it could, you can, I don't want to say lose yourself, but you can lose perspective. So I think it's been a good thing. Some others may feel differently because, you know, it is a balance, you know, balancing my daytime job with my legislative duties. Took some time to find that balance, but thankfully, you know, Bristol Myers and has provided me that flexibility. But also, you know, I've learned to balance my days, and it's you know, 6 years in, I feel like I've got it down now. But there are times where I got to walk that fine line.
Yeah, I obviously cannot ignore the fact that you have been in the legislature during a global pandemic when life just shifted so much for all of us and really quickly. You know, I think about that a lot, how quickly everything sort of changed for all of us. And there are lots of ways in which people really look to the legislature to be a body to help folks out during this really difficult time. I wonder what the pressure of that has been like for you and your colleagues, right? Particularly, you know, as you say, somebody who wants to help people and who wants to serve the public at a time where there are, you know, serious fiscal concerns and health concerns and so many different things going on. How do you work in an environment that, to me at least, seems like it would be incredibly stressful?
Yeah, when all this was, you know, when the pandemic first hit, you know, none of us thought it would be to the level that it has become, and that it's, you know, that it's still with us. And, you know, when you're looking at just from a state budget perspective, when you look at the impact the pandemic has had on the state budget and the tough decisions that need to be made just to balance the budget, whether it's cutting funding to the programs that we all care about or shifting funds from one program to another, those are decisions that you don't take lightly. But more importantly, you know, not only my district office, but district offices throughout the entire state have just been overwhelmed with constituents saying, we need help. We've called, you know, we're unemployment assistance, you know, we're not getting any calls back from the state. It's just, there's just so many different things, and your heart just hurts, and it goes out to these folks that just need that assistance. And I, you know, as legislators, we can only do so much, but we've got wonderful staffs of people that on a day-to-day basis are having these conversations with not only our constituents, but the state, trying to make sure that folks are getting their unemployment funds. And there's just so many issues that have come along. And I know I'm preaching to the choir that have come along with this pandemic. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, I always tell, you know, our staff in our office, you all are doing the best that you can. You know, they come to work and they work their, you know, 12 hours a day just trying to get through the amounts of emails and phone calls. But that's what we're here for. I say none of us were forced to get involved in public service. This is something that we chose. So we've got to take that on and do the best that we can each and every day. And that's what I try to do. I can't speak for, you know, every member of the legislature, but I'm pretty confident that's how all of us take our jobs. And I'm fortunate. I have a wonderful district that I work in, where my colleague in the assembly, a guy by the name of John Berticelli, he's been in office for 16 years. He's been a great mentor to me, a great source of information. And then my colleague on the Senate side is a guy by the name of Steve Sweeney, who serves as the Senate president. So I've got, you know, he's the main reason that I got involved. You know, he inspired me to want to get involved in public service. So it's I'm fortunate to be with two great guys that have really helped guide me in my understanding of how this all works.
Absolutely. I want to talk a little bit as well about your work on the Law and Public Safety Committee. I imagine, so, you know, we had the pandemic going on this year, which was incredibly difficult, but we also had some really tough conversations as a country about policing and criminal justice and racism and, you know, all sorts of issues. Do you feel like we are, you know, moving in the right direction? I mean, I think it's been hard to try to have those conversations in conjunction with also, you know, having the pandemic. And yet they're so critical and so meaningful to lots of people's lives. And it feels like we're moving in a good direction and that there are interesting things happening, like the marijuana referendum that went through, and what is that going to look like? But these issues obviously aren't going to go away, right? We're still going to be thinking about prisons. We're still going to be thinking about police. So what's your take on where you think we are and where you think we're going?
Yeah, I think you spoke it very clearly that this pandemic and, you know, the issues that we all witnessed over the summer really cast a strong light on the issues that we've all known about for years. But I think, you know, certainly speaking from a legislative standpoint, the conversations are happening now at a much higher level and people are listening. Are we where we need to be? You know, I don't think anyone would agree with that. Are we taking steps in the right direction? I would say yes. Certainly in our Law and Public Safety Committee, over in the Judiciary Committee, and so many committees on the Assembly and Senate side have taken up issues such as, you know, the policing and the tactics that are used. You know, just in my committee last week, we were talking about prison reentry. So making sure that folks that are in prison have an opportunity to get back to their lives, and that we're providing them with the appropriate resources to be successful when they're released. You know, the pandemic, you know, our prisons were ravaged by COVID. Are they getting the appropriate protection behind bars? These are individuals that are people too, and sometimes, you know, unfortunately they are forgotten about. So what could we be doing to make sure that they are treated as they should be treated? So, you know, for me, I was pleased to hear from the governor down and from our attorney general that these are conversations that are important to everybody. And that, you know, we're taking steps in the right direction. So I think, you know, as you mentioned with the marijuana side, the reason marijuana, you know, it was on the ballot, it was voted out overwhelmingly, but we still haven't voted out, you know, created regulations around it, because there's a social justice component to the marijuana legislation that is still being talked about. So I think, you know, it has been an eye opener for all of us, but I am truly thankful that we are all listening and that we're all, as I mentioned earlier, trying to work in the same direction.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a sense of momentum, which is really wonderful. And I hope that we can sustain it. And I hope that, you know, I think there are lots of ways in which, you know, as much as people like to make fun of New Jersey, this is a great state, right? I mean, this is a state where, you know, there are incredible opportunities for people, lots of wonderful places to live, great schools. And so I'm sort of excited by the idea that New Jersey could be a leader, really, on some of these issues and be an example for other parts of the country, hopefully. So,
yeah, I am with you 100% on that. As a guy that's lived in Jersey my entire life, we hear about, you know, high property taxes and different things. We're the butt of a lot of jokes, but yeah. I think we're all trying to, you know, make this place, make New Jersey a better place. And I think even more so, thankful to have you, you know, leading our wonderful law school. So, yeah. You know, thankful to have you here and, you know, just really honored to be talking with you.
Thank you. So I don't want to let you go without talking about your foundation. Mm-hmm. And the foundation strikes me as being, you know, an extension of your commitment to public service and your commitment to patient advocacy and to being a person who is a helper in the world. So can you tell folks what your foundation does?
Yeah. So, you know, the foundation, you know, 20 years ago when I was going through my injury, over $500,000 was raised for my lifetime care because the news reports, as I mentioned earlier, were that I was never going to walk again. So many wonderful people donated money to make sure that in the case that I wasn't going to be able to walk again, that I was going to have funds to help retrofit my home and really take care of anything that I needed to make sure that my life was comfortable in my current situation. I thankfully, you know, recovered and I didn't need those funds. But when I was going through the recovery process, I came across so many people that I was in a hospital with that didn't have the same resources that I had. They were getting kicked out of the hospital early because their insurance wasn't covering their basic physical therapy needs. So when I got out, it was actually my high school football coach who said, "Hey, you know, what do you think about creating a foundation to help provide some emotional financial support to patients?" Of course, we thought it was a great idea, and you know, that's where the foundation was born. 20 years ago. And the main goal of the foundation is to step in when insurance steps out. So if insurance isn't paying to help retrofit your home, if insurance isn't helping you purchase a van so you can have basic transportation needs, we try to provide the funds for that. You know, we had a gentleman who had a spinal cord injury and he wanted to just go back to college, but he needed a full-time nurse to be there with him, and his insurance wouldn't cover it. So, you know, we provided the funding so we could have a full-time nurse so he can go back to college. So, right. You know, we just provide that financial and emotional support to help people the same way that I was helped when I was going through my recovery. This has been around for 20 years, you know, and it's an entirely volunteer organization. So every dollar that's raised goes back to helping patients. And I'm just thinking, you know, my name, as I always say, my name's on the foundation. We have a great board president, a guy by the name of Tom Icavone, a great board of directors that really do the day-to-day work and making sure this foundation goes and that we're truly helping patients. So for me, it's a labor of love because my main role within the foundation is talking to the patients, hearing their stories, sharing my story, bouncing ideas off each other. And I'm just so thankful that the foundation is still living it and that we just had such great, and to this day have such great support from so many in the community. We have a few fundraisers throughout the year that really help us raise money to help patients. And it's just been a great experience for me.
That's really terrific. And, you know, it's interesting how, again, these sort of experiences that you never would have imagined, right? So, you know, the injury that happened to you, which of course nobody would ever wish that on somebody, but the ways in which you've been able to take that experience and use it to, you know, not only improve your life, but to improve so many other people's lives is really tremendous. So I want to ask you one more question. And this is a question that's sort of rooted in your experience as somebody who, you know, didn't grow up wanting to be a lawyer, but ended up going to law school. So if you had an opportunity to talk to, you know, somebody who was getting ready to start their career as a law student, and who maybe didn't quite know what they were going to do with that degree, but, you know, they want to earn it. What's a piece of advice or a couple pieces of advice that you would want to give to that person to help them, you know, start off on the right foot?
You know, the big thing that I wish I would have done this more when I was in law school was just networking, you know, networking with not only, you know, of course, when you think about networking, you think about interacting with folks that have already established themselves in a specific field. But I would say networking with your classmates, getting to know what they want to do, what path they're currently on, how you guys can, you know, work together. Because I remember there were days when I would go to law school. I was living at home with my parents. I'd go to law school and leave out and really didn't have much connection. So I would say, you know, get involved with the different programs that Rutgers Law has to offer, because there's so many great experiences that are at your fingertips when you're going through law school. And some of your classmates, even your professors, these are folks that could be helpful to you throughout your entire law career. And the biggest thing is just enjoy each and every day. I talk to folks that I went to law school with, and we always reminisce, say, man, you know, I wish we could go back to law school because it was such a good time. And, you know, you're learning something new every day. So it's such a fascinating experience.
Yeah. And I really appreciate that, that advice. One, because, you know, so many of our students, not all obviously, but so many of our graduates stay somewhere around, you know, this area, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, New York. So you're going to be running into these people constantly. So having those relationships that you can form in law school is just, you know, it's going to help you in your career ultimately. But I also just love the idea of somebody saying law school can be fun, right? It can be fun. It can be a place where you're, you know, meeting new people and having new experiences and, you know, doing things that you never thought that you would do. And for lots of folks, it's going to be their last experience in school. So why not take advantage of it? Absolutely. So Adam, I just want to thank you so much for your time. It was really wonderful getting to hear your story and getting to talk to you and hear about the amazing, amazing work that you're doing. And thank you so much for continuing to be a friend of the law school. And, you know, hopefully we'll be able to get you back there in person once we're able to be in the building again.
No, I just have to thank you. I know there's so many amazing, wonderful Rutgers Law alums you could be speaking to. So for you to even think about me, it was my absolute honor. And, you know, anything I could do as we go forward to support the law school, I'm happy to do it. But most importantly, thank you for everything that you're doing for Rutgers Law.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And whenever people say to me, you know, anything that I can do, I always like to warn them, I will take you up on that. So you'll be hearing from me.
That sounds good. I very much look forward to it.
Terrific. Thanks so much.
The Power of Attorney is produced by Rutgers Law School. With two locations, minutes from Philadelphia and New York City, Rutgers Law offers the prestige and reputation of a large, nationally known university with a personal small campus experience. Learn more by visiting law.rutgers.edu.